The list followed closely by Alabama and Tennessee. Even states on the low end of the scale, like Colorado and Massachusetts, report one in five adults are obese. Those who didn't graduate high school or who earn less than $15,000 a year are more likely to be overweight than their more well-to-do counterparts. Along with obesity, researchers say new data charts similar dramatic increases in diabetes and high blood pressure. The report says solutions include regulating food marketing to children and creating safe environments where people can exercise. Patty Namond, NPR News.
The positive reports on jobs today are boosting stock prices. The Dow Industrials are currently up 87 points at 12,714. The Nasdaq Composite Index is up 33. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Living Essentials, distributor of 5-Hour Energy, with flavors including lemon lime and pomegranate, in stores and at 5hourenergy.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Many of the websites that we use for shopping, for entertainment, collect information on us. They keep track of what it is we like to buy or watch or listen to. And then they use that information to recommend something new that they think we will like. And you know how that works. You download a song, and then whoever it is you get that song from, they look at that and they say, we see that you like this group. We have another group we think that you might like. Now, while there are a lot of people maybe who would not object to that, at least they would say, well, that's okay if it comes to recommending a movie or a song, there are also companies using that kind of profiling to filter search results for other kinds of information, news and information. And it's a kind of a thing that, according to our guest, and a lot of people feel has really serious implications, not only for our personal privacy, but also for our society. Our guest for the program in this hour is Eli Pariser. He's the board president, former executive director of the organization MoveOn.org. He is a pioneer in online politics, senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and he is the author of a new book which sets out this concern. The title of his book is The Filter Bubble, and the subtitle is What the Internet is Hiding from You. It has recently been published by the Penguin Press, so you can find it wherever it is you get your books. And as we talk, questions are welcome. We hope that people will be brief and be on target with their questions, but questions certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number to call. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, so use that. It's 800-222-9455. And if you would like to send us an email, you can do that too. The address is will-talk. Got to get the hyphen in there, though. will-talk@illinois.edu. And Eli Pariser, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much. Well, thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. Here, I guess, the way that we could illustrate here the basic issue is to say, let's imagine we have a group of people. Say we have 10 people, and we'll try to get 10 people that are really different in various ways. 10 people, 10 different computers. We set them all down and we go, not to pick particularly on Google, but say we pick Google as a search engine. So we've got 10 people, 10 different computers. We have asked them to put in the same, all 10 of them put in the same search term for, you know, whatever it is. The idea, I guess, we would expect is, well, if everybody is using the same search engine, they put in the same term, that the hits that come up, the websites that come up, should be all the same, but they're not.
That's right, and that didn't always used to be the case. You know, Google famously rose to dominance as a search engine by offering what it called the PageRank algorithm, which was a way of getting the web to kind of meritocratically or democratically vote on what the right response was to a given query using links as votes. And since about 2007, though, Google has been moving away from that way of doing search and towards something that's much more about providing the top results for you rather than the top results for everyone. So different people can get very different search results. And I tested this recently. I asked some friends to Google Egypt and to send me shots of what they got. And the differences were really quite striking. One of my friends, and this was right at the time when the protest movement in Egypt was in full swing, you know, one of my friends got results for Egypt that had a lot of information about the protests, about what was happening there in the political context. The other friend literally got nothing about that. As far as he was concerned, it might as well not have happened. He just got tips for going to see the pyramids. Mm-hmm. And so increasingly online, you know, we're living in different worlds based on who these companies think we are and what they think we want to see. And that creates, you know, what I call a filter bubble. It creates this sort of personal, unique universe of information that we live in online and that's increasingly hard to escape.
Yeah, I think that the important point that you're making here, one of the important points is that this is something that goes on and people aren't aware of it. And I probably would have said, you know, well, I had thought that Google was still doing it the way that they used to do it. As you say, it was based upon you get your hits based on how many hits particular sites get. So it's sort of an idea is, well, you would think that theoretically the most frequently visited sites are the ones that are going to be the best. And that was the way they were ranking in the what came up and in what order it came up. And I'm sure that they would be people who would be surprised to learn, in fact, they are tailoring the results this way now. And it's all about you, the individual, and not about what the aggregate is clicking on. They're keeping track of what you are clicking on and using that to tailor the results.
That's right. And, you know, this is a shift that's happening not just at Google, but all over the web. In fact, it's hard to find a major website that is not either actively using this kind of personalization technology or planning to. A vice president at Yahoo, Tapan Bhatt, says that personalization is the future of the web. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO, now the board member of Google, says that that it'll be very hard in the near future for people to find content that's not in some way targeted to them. This is sort of, as far as the technologists are going, can see it, the future of the internet. And what it means is that increasingly, when we visit a website, you know, we're not all seeing the same thing. We're seeing what that website calculates that we're most likely to click on and most likely to, you know, want to see based on the data it's collected about who we are. Now, the interesting thing about this is that, you know, the data collection doesn't have to be very obvious. It's not just things like, you know, putting in your name and figuring out who you are by name. It's also things like, what kind of computer are you on? Are you on a Mac or a PC? If you're on a Mac, you may get different results than a PC because the demographics of the groups that buy those two computers are different. Or what are the font sizes that you're using on your computer? What is the browser that you're using? You know, so there's a massive amount of data that we hand over to these companies without even knowing it that they can then use to zoom in on and profile who we are and show us results for people like us.
Yeah, and apparently even I suppose there's some kind of art to this, but it is possible that at least people do take sometimes a very small amount of information. It doesn't take very much, and they extrapolate a great deal about you from there. One might, I guess, argue about how accurate it is, but it's something that's done.
That's right. I mean, the company Hunch.com does this kind of personalization as part of its core business. And what Chris Dixon, one of the founders of Hunch, told me was that actually you only need about 5 data points on a person to be able to predict most of the rest of their preferences with an 80% accuracy. So think about that, just 5 pieces of data, and all of a sudden you can tell what kind of pasta they're likely to like or what kind of cars they're likely to drive or music or even political tastes. So that's not to say that it's a nuanced, you know, good portrait of what that person is like or what that person's interests are, but it's enough to start to make money by providing more tailored ads and more tailored content.
And there, I think, is another important point here, and that goes to the question of, for the people that are doing this tailoring, what's the motivation? And I think the concern, you know, going back even before there was the internet, I suppose going back all the way to Orwell, is the concern that something like this will be done for purposes of political manipulation. And it seems in the case of, that we're talking about here, that it's not about that at all. What it's about is for the search engines or whether whoever it is doing that, it's about money. So really, rather than being so much politically driven, it's driven by the economic interest of the information portal that you're using.
Yep, I don't actually think there's anything malicious about what these companies are trying to do. They're not, in an Orwellian sense, trying to block certain kinds of information from us. But essentially, they're playing the roles of editors. Increasingly, this kind of personalization code stands between us and the world, determines what we see and what we don't, makes decisions about what is important to see and what's not important, and the order of information, whether it's a search engine or a website like Yahoo News, which is increasingly personalized, or even the New York Times or the Washington Post, both of which are investing heavily in a kind of personal news service. This code is doing a lot of the things that human editors used to do. And one of the problems is that the code just doesn't have embedded in it the kind of editorial ethic sensibility that human editors do. The code doesn't pay much attention, for example, to what kinds of things might be socially important, even if they're not very sexy or very clickable, even if they're not likely to, create the kinds of user response that the code is keyed in on.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem, that whole swath of what we expect to see in news fall out of sight because they don't meet the criteria that these algorithms are searching for.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I don't know if this is a painting with too broad a brush, but it makes one think about 1984 and Orwell, and if people will recall the idea of a future in which the government dominates everything, it dominates people's thinking, it tells them what to think. It's the gateway through which all news and information pours. So what you get is the view of the world that the government wants you to have, and that's the concept of Big Brother. And that it does seem kind of interesting that now it seems that that Big Brother is not the government. Big Brother is Google, Yahoo, and Facebook.
Right, and I don't know that it's, I think in some ways this is somewhere in between Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, right?
Mm-hmm.
Aldous Huxley in Brave New World writes about sort of a population where it's not that someone is brainwashing them. It's in a way that they're so consumed with kind of mindless entertainment that they, miss the bigger picture. And when you think about Facebook and what the dynamics of a system like Facebook are, they're really not that far off. Facebook is all about the like button, and that's the way that people propagate information on Facebook. And increasingly, for better or worse, Facebook is the place where people get their information about news, about what's going on. Now, the thing about the like button is that it has a very particular valence. It's a positive word, and it's easy to click like on I ran a marathon, or I baked a cake, or here's a cute puppy. It's hard to click like on, genocide continues in Darfur, or war in Afghanistan enters its 11th year, or, climate continues to warm. So certain kinds of topics get, spread very quickly on Facebook. They get a lot of attention on Facebook, and other kinds of topics just kind of slide out of view. And the challenge, because this kind of personalized filtering happens invisibly, there's not a lot of indication of on what basis information is being ruled in or ruled out, you may not even know that you're missing that stuff. You may not even be able to see, what it is that your attention is being directed away from.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Eli Pariser. He's the board president and former executive director of MoveOn.org. He's also a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and he is the author of a newly published book that's titled The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. It's published by the Penguin Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email to will-talk at illinois.edu. Is it is it possible, because I'm sure that there are some people that would say in some circumstances they would be okay with this. So maybe they would say, well, yes, if it's my entertainment media that I'm interested in, if somebody wants to match me up with a book or a movie or a song that they think I'm going to like based on my past choices, well, you know, that's okay. But what you don't want it doing the other thing, you don't want it restricting your view of the world so that if there are important things that are going on, you won't know about them because whoever it is that's doing your search for you thinks that you don't care. You know, is there some way that you can actually have make the best of both?
Right. Well, I think that's the real question. And, you know, I think in some contexts, like with the Netflix movies, you know, this kind of thing can be helpful. But what's happening is that the same kind of kinds of algorithms, the same kinds of tools that were used to target ads or target products are now targeting information. And it's one thing to say, if you like this movie, you'll like that movie. And it's another to say, if you like this fact, you'll like that fact. That's the world that we're moving toward. And that's where it gets sort of more concerning, because it means that, you know, we do live in our own bubbles. That means that we do see the information that we want to see and not get confronted necessarily with the things that we may need to see but may not want to click on. A lot of the most important things, in fact, you know, and a lot of the learning that happens when we're confronted with information that, you know, we'd rather not be confronted with. And if we're living in an online world where that's less likely to happen, I think it means that, you know, we don't learn as much. We don't have as good a view of the world. We're not able to make as good decisions. And at a societal level, that we're not able to make as good decisions together because we can't see what other points of view are.
Mm. I have a caller here we'll get right to. I guess I expect some people might say that as long as, first of all, you're aware of this, that then in the way you use these search tools, that should be able to get you around the problem. You know, for example, going back to your example of the two people who sat down and both put Egypt into their browsers, and the one person got all this information about the political upheaval that was going on, and the other person, they just got travel information because in the one case, the search engine had seen past behavior and knows, oh, this person is interested in international politics, and the other person is apparently just likes travel. But I'm sure that some people would say, well, you can get around that very easily by changing your search terms even just slightly and putting in either Egypt politics or Egypt travel. And depending on whether you really actually wanted one or the other, you would get that. Wouldn't something relatively simple like that get you around this?
Well, in Google's case, yes. If you understand that this is going on, you understand on the basis on which Google is doing this kind of sorting, you absolutely can get closer to what it is that you're searching for. The problem is that it is done invisibly. You don't see how it's being done or on what basis it's being done. It's complicated or it's clunky to turn off, and you can't turn it off completely. You can turn it off partially, but not completely. There's some history to this, actually. In the mid-90s, there was a whole boom in what was then termed intelligent agent software, which the sort of most familiar face of that is Clippy, that little annoying Microsoft question and answer icon.
Mm-hmm.
And Clippy is sort of par for the course in that most people, when they came into contact with these intelligent personalized agents that were supposed to seek out the information just for us and do all these chores for us, it became very clear that this was like an incredibly annoying and frustrating and task, that this software really didn't know us at all. And the whole industry dropped that approach like a hot potato. What's happened now, in a way, is that same mentality has come back, but instead of embodying it in a little cartoon figure, it's just embedded in the web. We don't see it happening, and because we don't see it happening, we don't notice as much when it has us wrong or when it's misdirecting us or pointing us down the wrong route. But we don't see that at work, and so. I think that is one of the big challenges, is this is happening kind of unaccountably and invisibly, and as a result, it's hard for people to use the tool in the way that they want to.
Yeah. We have a caller here, someone in Mansfield, so we'll talk with them. This is line number one. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. David made the comment that it wasn't politics that was driving this trend, but it was money. But I thought the Supreme Court ruled that politics was money. Thank you very much.
Well, you can comment on that. I'm not exactly sure how that connects with what we're talking about. What they were talking about was that the court was ruling that it was unconstitutional to limit the amount of money someone would spend on a campaign because they equated money with speech. I'm not sure how that applies in this case. Maybe you see a way where it does.
Yeah, I'm a little confused about that as well. But, you know, I think, one of the challenges with these systems, it's not unlike, some of the dynamics around money in politics, is that, essentially you get these distortion effects in these filters based on what the advertiser's interests are. So, for example, on Facebook, you know, there is a like button. There isn't an unlike button or a dislike button. And there's a pretty simple reason for that, which is that advertisers love the like button. They love people being able to say, I like Nike. They really don't want people being able to say, I dislike Nike. And as a result, you know, that's not an option that's available. Obviously, it would change what kinds of information move across Facebook if people were able to indicate, this is something I really dislike and I want my friends to dislike it too. And it might have a political consequence as well if people could call that kind of thing out. So I think as we live more of our lives in these kind of online platforms, it's really important to actually understand what is driving them. How are they being shaped? What are the forces that are pushing what options exist and what options don't? And how does that shape how our society is developing? How does it shape what we know?
Well, if we're not getting at the point that the caller wanted us to address, my apologies, and she's welcome to call back and redirect. Otherwise, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you may do that too. The address is will-talk@illinois.edu. To another caller, Urbana, line four. Hello.
Yes, hello, sir.
Hi.
A very interesting topic. I'm noticing you set up a sort of, dichotomy, I guess, between human editors who, as you said, can exercise something of, a conscience or are at least, supposed to sort of uphold a, sort of an editorial moral code. And then the, computerized algorithms. And you've also, suggested that there's a larger difference or more general difference between paper newspapers that ostensibly at least don't filter what you're looking at, and then, online content that is filtering, as you say, and obviously is true. I wanted to ask, certainly the web may do it to a much greater extent, but do you think it's possible that paper newspapers, at least, are actually already doing that in the sense that people pre-select what information they want to see by choosing to look at, let's say, the New York Times or the Washington Post or, CNN or NPR or MSNBC or something like that. Is it that the Internet is sort of disappointing from what most people think it is, this sort of pure portal, unmitigated portal to information, or is your claim that the Internet should actually be doing something else, not just sort of disappointment in what we may have held as a view, but that the Internet should do something differently? Okay, thanks very much.
All right, thanks. Well, I think that's a marvelous question, and there are actually several questions there. And maybe the basic question is, your concern is with filtering, but even with traditional media, there was filtering. So isn't there always going to be someone, either there'll be a person filtering or there'll be an algorithm filtering, but somebody's going to be filtering.
That's right. The question is, there are a couple differences here. One is, what is the, how obvious is the editorial sensibility of the filter? So when I pick up The Nation or I turn on Fox News, I kind of know on what basis information is being edited in and edited out. I know what the editorial viewpoint is. And as a result, I kind of have a sense of what stories are likely to be left on the cutting room floor. But because we don't know who Yahoo News or who Google News thinks we are, we don't know on what basis we're seeing the information that we're seeing. We don't know, therefore, on what basis we're not seeing information, what the kinds of information are that are being edited out. And, like Donald Rumsfeld once said, there are sort of known knowns and known unknowns and unknown unknowns, and it's the unknown unknowns that are the most dangerous. This is sort of, at its worst, a way of having a lot of unknowns unknowns. You don't even know what you're missing. I would say, to the other question that the caller raised, I think this is exactly to the point. We are moving from these systems where people got their information via these kind of human editorial gatekeepers to systems where people are getting information via code gatekeepers. And the gatekeepers are doing a lot of the same things that the humans did. They're, deciding what we see and what we don't and doing this kind of editorial work. But they haven't really yet, the people building Facebook don't take responsibility in a lot of ways for that incredibly powerful role that they have, like a lot of journalistic outlets do. They don't see themselves as having this kind of really important civic duty of filtering well and making sure that people see things that are important as well as things that are highly likable. And I think that's really one of the shifts that we need to make. As these new media companies replace the old media, we need them to take their responsibilities seriously now that a huge amount of information and Internet traffic runs through them.
All right. I want to thank the caller. We'll go to somebody else here in Urbana and line two. Hello. Is there a caller there, Urbana, line two? Well, I don't know. Maybe we can check and see. Otherwise, other callers are welcome, 333-9455, a toll-free 800-222-9455. And again, if you'd like to send an email, we'll be happy to take your question comment that way. The address is will-talk at illinois.edu. Just going back to the last point that you're talking about, I think that, in the early days of the Internet, I think one of the things that people were really excited about was the idea that that there would be no gatekeeper. I mean, theoretically, at least that was the idea, and that you would be your own gatekeeper. That is, you'd have access to this wide range of information, and that it wasn't somebody else deciding. You were deciding.
But that's right. That was sort of the mythology. Yeah. Was that the Internet was just going to sweep, the existing gatekeepers all out of the way. Yeah. All of a sudden, everybody could talk to everybody. Everyone could connect directly to everyone else. And the Internet, unfortunately, isn't really looking that way. It's not the case that I connect directly with my friends. I connect with them through Facebook. And it's not the case that I connect directly with a local small business. I connect with it through Google. And so standing in the middle of an increasing number of our Internet transactions and in the middle of Internet life are these massive companies that right now are trying to optimize for page views and for ad views and for ad revenue. That's sort of what they're about. And as a result, as I said, there's sort of some problems that emerge because there's plenty of information that just doesn't make it through those filters that perhaps we would really benefit from a lot of people seeing or knowing.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Eli Pariser, and we're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his new book, The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. We'll have more after a short break. This is Focus.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings with two different topics for you each day, 10 different topics every week, two different topics every day. In the second hour today, the 11 o'clock hour, Celeste Quinn will be hosting the program, and it will be about computers, but in a more pragmatic and practical way. This is the show we do every month. It's called Computers and You. So this is your chance to call in and do some troubleshooting. Maybe you're having problems with a computer or you wanted to do something and you're not quite sure how. Celeste will have two guests, Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick. They're with the Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services site at the U of I. So whether you're looking for a new computer, you have questions about online security, you need some troubleshooting advice, they will do their best to help. That's in hour two today. You can go to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu, and see the schedule for this program so you can see what's ahead. You can also catch up on past programs that you might have missed. It's there on our web archive. So again, it's WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest Eli Pariser. He's the board president, former executive director of MoveOn.org. He's a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and he is the author of a recent book that's titled The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. It's published by the Penguin Press. Questions are welcome. We have several here. We'll just keep on talking with folks. 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Lafayette, Indiana. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering if places like Google and others where you don't have to log in keep track of you just by your IP address. And so if you have an IP address that's used by a lot of different people, you'd kind of get a mixture of information.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. Like, you know, for example, I guess if you went down to the public library and you use that computer, well, all kinds of people use that computer. Are you going to get a different result?
You will. And to the caller's question, Google does track by IP address. That's your computer's numerical address on the Internet. So even if you're not logged in, Google often has a pretty good sense of who you are because it knows, for example, that your household is searching for certain kinds of things and not other kinds of things. The technology here has really gotten more and more sophisticated because, in a way, this is sort of the race that is animating Silicon Valley right now, the race to suck up as much personal information as possible. And Google and Facebook and Microsoft and Yahoo and a number of these other companies are sort of all competing to see who can figure out more and more different pieces of data to track and how better to get consumers to share more and more information with them so that they can tailor ads and so that they can tailor content.
So now if they wanted to use the IP address so they could figure out something about where you are, like if you were at a university, they might use that information, or if you were through some other low-cost service, they might use that. If you're coming from a high-cost service, they might use that. Is that something that would be helpful, especially like if it's a university, you might figure they have different interests than somebody else?
Yeah, that's right. You can actually, track. You can get a pretty good sense of location from IP address as well. And Google has spent a lot of energy trying to figure out the location of particular computers by IP address. You can actually see this if you load up Google Maps and click the little person icon. It will guess where you are based on your IP address, even if you haven't put in an address. So, the technology there is pretty strong, and it means that, and again, you know, I should stress, Google's intent here is partly to provide a service that will, for example, help people get, you know, when they Google pizza, they'll get the pizza place down the road and not the pizza place halfway across the country. But as a result, it also means that you get the search results when you Google Barack Obama or you Google climate change or you Google, debt. you get search results that are inflected in a way by your locality.
But if they were to see that you're calling from some university, then they might figure that your interests were different than if you were calling from some other IP provider. Although they might not be able to detect that you're calling from a library, they might be able to detect, you know, that you, if they want to, they could certainly tell that you're calling from a university as opposed to some community IP service.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, thanks for the call. Let me just real quick here ask, for example, I'm now sitting in front of the computer I have here in the studio, and I'm using Firefox, and that uses Google as a search engine, or at least that's where I have it now. And one of the things that you can do here is if you look at your tools, there's a setting that says private browsing. And I believe that there are some other search engines that will essentially do that same thing. That now, if you do that, that will in some small measure but not completely insulate you from some of this?
Yeah, that's right. If you turn on the private browsing window, essentially what that does is it turns off temporarily the pieces of tracking code called cookies that these sites put on your computer so that they can figure out quickly who you are. And you get a somewhat less personalized web experience, but even then, things like what kind of computer you have, what IP address you're logging in from, all of those things continue to be tracked and can be used to personalize what kind of news or content you're seeing if the site has that capability.
And now is it the case that just about anybody, we don't mean particularly to pick on Google, but that's so widely used, everybody's sort of familiar with that. Is it the case that pretty much whatever kind of search engine you use, everybody's doing this now?
Well, a lot of them are. The major ones certainly are. Google and Bing are. But, you know, there are options that don't do this. For example, DuckDuckGo.com. I have no idea why it's called that, but it's a memorable name. DuckDuckGo.com is a search engine that does not personalize. They don't track this kind of information. And it's no Google. It's not quite as good, but it does demonstrate that you don't have to be able to track this information in order to deliver real search results.
All right, back to the phones here. And someone in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hi. I may be a little bit off subject because I am somewhat concerned about the tracking issues, but I have to say that in so many ways the Internet has really expanding the kind of information and things that I'm able to get. One of the things that I'm very interested in is issues surrounding labor and things like that. And, you know, like virtually daily, I'm getting things from you guys at MoveOn.org, and I'm also getting things from, you know, AFL-CIOs and, you know, political things and stuff. And places to go and actually get labor news. So some of the things, and that's something I've just never been able, you know, until you know, signing up for some of these things on the computer, you know, and maybe going to some of these spots or something. I'm never absolutely sure how come I get some of these emails. But then they direct me to things that I'm really actually interested in reading. And then I don't notice it so much on the other end of things because I'm not really a person who uses, you know, just general searching like Google for finding out news. In fact, I'm kind of, I guess, filtering myself because I'm looking for certain kinds of news, which is not easy for me to find in other ways. So I don't know whether I'm too far off the subject to get a comment there, but, you know, there certainly is, you know, the computers definitely do have some positives. And, you know, to me, I'd be absolutely delighted if somehow or another I started actually from some of these Google searches and things actually getting some labor news for them to come up with, if I'm very interested in that.
Hmm. Right. Well, this is, I mean, it's absolutely on topic, and it's the reason that many of these companies are investing heavily in this. It's very useful to have someone do a lot of the sorting through of all of the mountains of information on the internet and actually find the stuff that's relevant to you in some way, that's relevant to your actual interests. And it's true that in the sort of 20th century broadcast society, because it was essentially lowest common denominator media, you were trying to find how do we gather the biggest possible audience around our particular newspaper or TV show. You know, these sort of more specialized interests, often didn't get covered at all. So I think the challenge is, if you're interested in labor news, that increasingly that's the thing that, that you can only see that, and that you can miss, for example, the international news or the news about, other related topics that actually inform what's going on there, but that might not, that an algorithm might not expect that you're interested in. There's another function, too, that I think newspapers at their best provide, which is that they give you some sense of things that are going on, even if they think you're not interested in them. And, so if you imagine, sort of most people, glance at the newspaper's front page and then they go to a section that they like. Maybe it's the movie section or the home and garden section. But you do stop by the front page first and you see, oh, yeah, there's a new offensive in Afghanistan. There's this political scandal going on. And that's the way that a lot of people actually get political information and make political decisions. Now that it's possible just to live in your own personal section, you don't have that. People pass by the front page and miss a lot of the actually important things that are going on.
That's making an interesting assumption that those people know what you're interested in more or what is important to you more than you do. That's making a very interesting assumption because I could read the local paper from, cover to cover and not find these kinds of stories.
Well,
and, I listen to the BBC simply because I find out more about, national news from the BBC than I do local coverage or, even ABC, CBS, those kinds of things. I'm definitely an NPR junkie, but when it comes down to, some of these things that I think a lot of people besides me are actually interested in, what's happening to working people, blah, 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 what's happening in the middle class, blah, 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 I'm not sure I'm going to find it in a lot of these other things.
Well, I agree with you. I mean, I think those are topics that, are important for people to hear about. What I worry about actually is that, well, I think you're sort of a particular case of a person who's really interested in these public-oriented issues. I think if you look at the dynamics of what kinds of information spread on Facebook or come through in the personalized Google News, unfortunately, for most people, it's not those issues. And it means that, the group of people who are seeking out information on labor news can find it, but it also means that other groups of people who wouldn't naturally seek that out may never see it at all. And, for example, Google News prioritizes stories about Apple Computer over stories about the war in Afghanistan because more people click on stories about Apple Computer than stories about the war in Afghanistan. To me, it seems like a problem that, people need to know about the war in Afghanistan, even if, we're not all clicking on it compulsively because it's one of the biggest issues we're involved in. We're spending, over $1 trillion there. We're sending men and women to die there. It would be a bad thing if we lived in a media world in which that was essentially edited out because, people were reading stories about the next iPhone.
Well, I appreciate
that. I guess I'm curious as to how many people actually, you like something, but, I like Anne of Green Gables, for example. I didn't go in there and read the story about it, it's kind of, general silliness, liking something. I can't imagine people actually getting much news from something like that, but.
Unfortunately, for better or worse, a lot of people are. I mean, that's sort of the challenge is, you have 30% of people under 30 saying that Facebook and other social news sites are one of the primary places they get their political information. In a way, this is sort of like the, you know, the Daily Show problem, which is, you know, the Daily Show didn't set out to be a news source, but it became one for better or for worse for a large, you know, group of people. And all of a sudden it had this responsibility that it wasn't really seeking out in the first place. You know, I think that's sort of where Facebook is in a lot of ways. It started as, you know, never intending to be a news source for millions or billions of people, and now 1 in 11 human beings is on it, and it is becoming the place that people actually get a sense of what's going on in the world.
One thing to call, we just have about 5 minutes, and I have one more call I'd like to get in Sycamore on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Fascinating topic, and I wanted to maybe have your guests sum up some of the precautions you can take for enhancing your anonymity. And I gather that that is one of the first is to make sure you clean out your cookies on a very regular basis. And another is make sure that you use a line that is not one that you use all the time. In other words, that other people can use. I think one of the other callers mentioned go to the library and you maintain an anonymity that way. And then the last thing would be, is there some way that your computer actually sends its serial number over so it's uniquely identified?
Well, it's a great question, and increasingly that is possible. It's not the computer's serial number, but there are a number of unique identifiers and a combination of the hardware and the software that allow for what's called machine fingerprinting. And that's actually sort of a growing, there are several new startups that are doing that kind of thing and offering that service to advertisers so that you can actually see this is the same computer logging on to this website, even if the person is otherwise totally, you know, anonymous. On my website for the book, thefilterbubble.com, I do list 10 things that you can do to dial down the amount of personalization you're going to see, and that's, you know, right on the website, thefilterbubble.com. But I think that, you know, as much as each of us individually, you know, there are things that we can do to confront this, I think a lot of it is about encouraging these companies that, for better or worse, do control an enormous amount of the Internet attention and Internet traffic, to really step it up and to take the responsibility that they have in the middle of that transaction more seriously. You know, to give a sort of trivial first step kind of example, you know, Facebook could, next to the like button, could put an important button that would allow people to signal, you know, this is actually something that really matters, that people should know about. And you could have the Facebook news feed essentially showing people some mix of those things. You know, Google could have a slider at the top that allows people to see search results for people just like them and search results for people really unlike them. And, you know, it's kind of taking people seriously as adults, I think, you know, that can, and giving them the tools to actually control these filters rather than passively just deciding what they see and don't see. I think that's sort of the direction that we need to move if we're going to have these algorithms increasingly shaping what we know about the world.
Okay, thanks very much.
We're coming down to having a couple of minutes here. There's something that a question I really should have introduced a little bit earlier in the program, but it has to do with, for someone like Google, for them to do the tailoring of search results to the individual in this way that we have talked about, I understand that for them this means money, in a sense, that what we're talking about is their economic interests are at stake here. And the question is, well, how does it make them money? How is it that they do better? What's in it for them that they tailor your information to, you know, they connect this information about you, try to figure out who you are, what you want, and then they tailor this information to you based on this profile that you've constructed that is in part based on your past behavior. Again, the question is, well, what's in it for them?
Well, what's in it for Google is that when you present people with information that they are more likely to click more quickly, they'll use your service more. That's sort of the core thing behind the search results personalization is, Google has done a lot of studies that show them that when they provide search results where the top result is more likely to be something that you'll click, you'll come back more, and therefore you'll view more ads, and therefore they'll make more money. Now, the challenge is, for some queries, that makes perfect sense. When you're Googling, again, your local pizza place, you want Google to kind of guess which pizza place you're talking about. But when you're Googling climate change, that's not really what you're after. That's not the point of that kind of query. And it can be dangerous if Google is starting to show you just the results that it thinks you're going to be interested in. Likewise, I had a conversation with a Google PR person who said, and he said, look, we're just trying to give people what's most relevant for them. I said, yeah, but that's a hard question. You know, if I'm a 9/11 conspiracy theorist and I Google 9/11, is it your job to show me the conspiracy website I'm most likely to click on, or is it your job to actually show me the Popular Mechanics article that debunks all of that stuff? And being a PR guy, he kind of sputtered and said he would have to get back to me. But I think that's really the challenge, that there are these really important value judgments that are embedded in the code in these platforms, and that these companies sort of evade some of the responsibility that comes with making those value judgments.
Hmm. And just real quick, I mean, is anybody looking at designing better search tools, perhaps that give the searcher more control over the results? And I guess, in other words, what I'm looking for is an anti-filter filter. Does such a thing exist, or are people thinking about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's sort of the next step is, finding ways to give people better tools to be able to manage these kinds of information and actually make more of these decisions for themselves. Google just launched a new social network called Google+ that actually, in some ways, embraces that idea more. You know, it's giving people some more control so that instead of having Google have a mysterious algorithm that decides what posts you see and what posts you don't see, or instead of Facebook doing that, you actually have some control over it yourself. And we'll see how that develops.
Well, our guest this morning is Eli Pariser. He's the board president, former executive director of MoveOn.org. He's also a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute, and he is the author of the book, The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You. It's published by the Penguin Press. Mr. Pariser, thanks very much.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Here's a news item from the media world. News International says it is shutting down the News of the World tabloid that is at the center of a phone hacking scandal. James Murdoch, who heads the newspaper's European operations, says the 168-year-old paper will publish its last edition on Sunday. The scandal has cost the paper prestige and advertisers. More, I'm sure, on the story throughout the day in news from National Public Radio and on All Things Considered this afternoon here on AM 580 at 4. Coming up in the second hour of the program today, you'll have an opportunity to call in with questions about computers, practical kinds of questions. Maybe you're looking for a new computer. You have questions about online security, certainly something that all people with computers who are going on the Internet should be thinking about. Maybe you need some troubleshooting advice, any and all of that. Those are the kind of questions that we do on this program. We do once a month called Computers and You. Celeste Quinn will be the host, and her guests today will be Debbie Fleiger and Jim Eyrick. They're with Campus Information Technologies and Educational Services at the University of Illinois. So that's hour number two of our program today. Right now, we'll take our usual break so we can bring you news from National Public Radio at 1 minute past the top of the hour. Before that, an update on the commodity market, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
At 10:59 with this market update, I'm Tom Rogers. The wheat is still down in Kansas City, but up in Chicago, at least in the nearby contracts. Corn and beans also holding their up days so far today. July wheat in Kansas City is down 20.5 cents a bushel at 688.25. But in Chicago, the nearby July is at 625, up 13.75. September up 2.25 cents at 629.25. July corn is up 6.5 cents at 655.25 a bushel. September 627.75 is up 9. December, 6.15 and 3 quarters, up 7 and a quarter. August crude oil is standing at $98.39 a barrel, up $1.73 so far today. July beans are at $13.42 and a quarter, up 11 and a quarter cents. August at $13.37 and a half, up 15 and a quarter. Jump to November, the contract there, $13.36 and 3 quarters, up 18 and a quarter cent. July soybean meal, $342.50, up 80, and the July bean oil contract is up 78 at $56.05. August live cattle standing at $113.62 and a half.